Welcome to the V&A Podcast, bringing you behind the scenes of the Victoria and Albert Museum, the world's greatest museum of art and design. I'm Glenn Adamson, head of research at the V&A. In this episode, we'll be talking about engineering the museum. Every major architectural project needs an engineer. That's not just a matter of getting the building to stand up. Engineering is an art form in itself, which is considered in even the smallest details. The V&A is currently engaged in an ongoing renovation and extension of our galleries, a project we call Future Plan. This has required extensive consultation with engineers, and we have often turned to Arup, the world's largest and most well-known firm in the field. Here to discuss engineering at the V&A are Moira Gemmel, Director of Projects Design and Estate at the V&A, and Andy Sedgwick, Director of Building Engineering at Arup, who has worked on many of our projects, including the Medieval and Renaissance Galleries, which opened in 2009. Moira, I thought we might start by talking a little bit about the concept of engineering and how it's different from design. Everyone thinks of the V&A as a design museum. Probably not that many people think of us as involved with engineering. So what does this subject have to do with us?
It has everything to do with us. I don't see design and engineering being different in any way at all. It's another very important discipline that makes up the skill set that we need in order to realise what we do, particularly through our capital redevelopment programme. And if you think back to Francis Fouck, who designed a huge extent of the original V&A alongside other architects, but he was an engineer. So back in the middle of the 19th century, there was really no difference between architectural design and engineering.
And of course, the Crystal Palace that was constructed in Hyde Park, which predated our museum and made it possible to create the V&A, was also designed by an engineer, Joseph Paxton.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not sure what's happened sort of over the intervening years, but I get the sense that engineering is re-emerging as a very important discipline. More and more engineers are becoming architects, if you like.
So could you describe for us in general how we work with engineers at the V&A now? They're part of these projects, of course, that we're undertaking through Future Plan. That might be the most important thing.
With all of our capital projects, we pull together design teams that comprise architects, engineers, lighting specialists, acoustic specialists, graphic designers, many, many different disciplines. But key in each of those projects is the architectural and the engineering team. And we use lots of different engineering services like structural and mechanical and electrical. Those are the key disciplines within engineering that we use for each of our gallery projects. So, of course, when we're designing and building new architectural interventions that are perhaps making our buildings more easy to navigate by putting in new lifts, new staircases and so on, we need structural engineers to work through the designs for those. But we also need structural engineers to look at designs for our display cases. Some of our display cases are huge, like, for example, the Ardable carpet showcase in the Islamic Gallery. We couldn't have achieved that without the services of very clever engineering.
This is one of the largest and most precious carpets in existence, and this extraordinary huge case, which is almost like a little building in its own right.
Exactly right. The footprint of that case is bigger than the house I live in. And it moves up and down on this sort of hydraulic system, which is very, very clever, so that we can have access to the carpet underneath. But there are also mechanical and electrical services that we really need to build into each of our projects so that we can create the right environments for our collections on display. And we push our engineers quite hard, I think, to look at new and interesting and perhaps more passive means to create the environments that we need. So that's why we choose to work with engineers of the calibre of Arup, because we feel that they're able to take this initiative for us and really push the boundaries of engineering to create something that is sustainable.
Arup is indeed a firm that we turn to very frequently in our work, and we're lucky to be joined today by Andy Sedgwick from the company. Andy, perhaps you could begin by telling us a little bit about Arup, a little bit about its history and size. It is indeed a very, very big operation.
The firm was founded in the 1940s by Ove Arup, who was originally of Danish extraction. That's why we have that name. But he started the firm here in the UK. Initially, it was a firm of consulting structural engineers and did a lot of work with some of the main architectural proponents of the modernist school, Lebetkin and others. But really, over the intervening period, the firm has grown from that core base of structural engineering and now provides a very wide range of services here in the UK, but also now across five different regions around the globe. We have offices now in the Americas, Australasia, in Asia, and in Europe as well. The scope of what we do now covers large infrastructure projects, bridges and highways and rail, as well as all types of buildings. And as Moira said, there's so many technical disciplines now come together to make a modern building, particularly a museum. And we're pleased that we can provide most of those technical services in a coordinated way from within the firm. So the size of the firm now is around 10,000 people globally, with approximately 2,000 of those being in London.
Andy, you're only one of those people, but you've been with the firm for quite some time.
I joined in 1983, started work immediately actually on some museum projects. The Menil Collection in Houston, which is quite a well-respected art museum by Renzo Piano. And really, my career since then has been a series of museum projects, but interspersed with a wide variety of other projects too. So some of what we do is informed by what we learn from doing airport projects or office projects and so on. But I've always found the museum world particularly fascinating place to work as a designer.
So what makes working for a museum different for an engineer from working with any other kind of architectural project?
I think one of the questions that I asked myself when I began was, why are all museums different? The technical problems are often, on the face of it, similar. They're to do with climate control and carrying the load of the objects and so on, providing the appropriate lighting arrangements. But the fascination is in the drivers that make it different. They are often to do with the site, the climate, but they're very much to do with the collection. And one of the key steps, I think, in designing any new space or refurbished space is a real in-depth understanding of the objects that will be in there, be they a permanent collection or a temporary space, and the technical requirements that those objects need. So there's these sort of physical parameters that come from the collection and the site. But then the other thing that's always fascinating on museum projects are the range of people who are involved. And so the other thing that makes the projects different are the people.
And here you're talking about not only people like Moira, who you're working with as the head of our projects team, but you're also talking about curators, conservators, that kind of people as well.
Yes. The difference in curatorial approach from one museum to another can drive the design solution in very different directions.
So I suppose one thing listeners may be wondering is, while they can understand why that would be different for, let's say, an exhibition designer, what difference would that make for an engineer? How would a different curatorial approach mean a different experience or different requirements for the engineer?
This is possibly an oversimplification, but I could describe the Northern European approach to displaying objects as being a relatively naturalistic one, often using natural light to create the setting for the objects and to create a well-lit room in which objects are then displayed. So that will lead to often a series of roof lights, sort of classical galleries we see in London, the National Gallery and so on. It's very much in contrast to what's sometimes called the North American approach, which is very much more black box and the use of electric light to really focus the visitor's attention on the objects in a way that the curator set up. So it's a little bit more mediated. It's a bit more determined by the curatorial view, the sort of hierarchy of objects and so on.
I think what Andy said there is particularly relevant to the V&D. It's been our ambition over the last 10 to 12 years to bring more light into the V&D, more daylight. And many of our galleries were built with roof lights. Some have been covered up over the years, and we've been painstakingly reinstating them to allow light back into the building. By doing so, making it a pleasant space for the visitor, but also having to modify things to an extent to create the right climate control, the right environment for the collections.
I suppose daylight is one of these dynamics in a museum that has a huge positive aspect in that it's so beautiful and it's very attractive for the objects, which of course, in most cases, were designed to be seen by daylight. But it's also something that brings problems, because when you have light exposure for certain kinds of objects like textiles or works on paper, then that can cause a lot of damage over relatively short periods of times of exposure as well. So how do we balance that dynamic at the V&A?
Well, I think that's where the engineers and the architects and the in-house specialist teams need to work very closely together to recognise that it is crucial to bring daylight into the building, but also to understand that we need to protect the collections and to design the spaces, to design the sort of three-dimensional interiors of those spaces that then physically display the collections, to make sure that those collections are protected perhaps locally, rather than just blocking up windows, looking at how they can be positioned within a gallery space so that they're away from the source of daylight, so that we are filtering those rays out, but without actually blocking out the daylight to the extent where our visitors have no idea what the weather is outside. And we know that, you know, people find that really tiring and exhausting, and we want them to stay in the galleries. And it is just a proven fact that when there is daylight, people stay in the spaces longer.
It's one of these classic examples, isn't it, of if the visitors don't quite notice all this fine detailed work you've done, then you know you've done a good job.
Exactly right. And it's very difficult, I think, for our architects and engineers, because we have such an enormous site. We remain open. We have staff, we have visitors, we have priceless collections, and we have Grade 1 listed buildings to deal with.
Andy, you worked on the Medieval and Renaissance galleries, which we opened just a couple of years ago, which of course have a lot of daylight in them. Can you tell us a little bit from your perspective as a specialist in this field, how you achieved the maximum results in those spaces in particular?
The objects within Medieval and Renaissance do vary enormously in their capability of taking light, from very sensitive textiles through to some of the sculptural objects in the city part of Medieval and Renaissance that really are, you know, they're made of stone and have been outside often, so there's absolutely no sensitivity to light there at all.
This is part of the galleries where you almost feel that you're walking through a Renaissance piazza. Big sculptures around
yes.
you and architectural fragments, yeah.
That's right, the balcony and so on, looking down into that almost like a street or piazza. What I'd like to think we've achieved is a variation of daylight through those galleries that is actually quite pronounced. In terms of light levels, they vary perhaps by, on a bright day, the piazza might be 100 times brighter than some of the darker corners of the perimeter galleries.
Moira, what do we say at the museum about our status as a green institution? I know that's quite a conscious thing for most organizations at the moment. How do we think about that challenge, the sustainability of our physical plant?
It's something that we're very much focused on, and it's something that our estate department, I think, has been very successful in achieving a very good energy rating for the V&D, considering it is, you know, huge series of buildings over a 12.5-acre site. And when we adapt part of the building in one area, we're still getting to grips with the knock-on effect of that in the rest of the building.
Is it a particular challenge to work in a historic building? Because we mentioned Francis Falk as one of the foundational engineers of the architecture. But of course, if you have a 19th century building, it's not going to be designed with much of an eye towards optimal sustainability, is it?
Well, interestingly, I think it was. I think there were very clever systems that were put in place by the original architects and engineers of the building. And for example, in our recently renovated ceramics galleries, we reinstated some of those systems that had been blocked up for many, many years. But absolutely, it was all there from the beginning.
It's fascinating. Andy, can we close by just having a little word about engineering in general? I began by asking Moira about engineering and design in relation to one another, and she said she thought of them as, you know, pretty much one continuous activity. Is that how you see it too? Because I suppose a lot of people think of design as very aesthetic and expressive, and engineering is basically a lot of mathematical calculation. So how do you think of the profession in relation to design?
I think one of the fascinations about engineering, particularly for the built environment, is that it has both those aspects. There is, of course, a very serious and focused role in calculation and specification of materials that mean that when our intent is taken through into construction, that it's going to do the job we all want it to. So often we'll do very sophisticated calculations to make sure that we get where we want to. For example, the Exhibition Road project that we've just about finished the design of.
These are the new galleries that we're building on the west side of the museum.
Yes, a major new temporary exhibition gallery. It requires the excavation of a very deep hole immediately adjacent to three Grade 1 listed buildings. And so we need to be extremely sure, and we need to do a great deal of checking to make sure that things like ground movement that will inevitably happen when you make an excavation like that, that they are within the limits that we can expect the existing buildings to cope with. But alongside that more computational and technical role is the role engineers have in influencing the development of each project, hopefully right from the beginning. And I think the V&A projects have benefited from the whole design team being present from the beginning. So topics such as energy and structure and so on are given good voice at the beginning of projects and weighed against and coordinated with the other objectives of the project that will be to do with architecture and visitor experience and so on.
Just on that, Andy was talking about the Exhibition Road project, the new galleries that we're building below ground. And going back to the sort of difference or similarities in discipline and status, if you like, between architects and designers, we actually debated long and hard within the museum before we started this project as to whether the lead designer for the Exhibition Road galleries should be an engineer or an architect. And in the end, we decided to go with an architectural lead. But it was a very real debate and a really interesting one, because this project relies very much on the engineering side of the design team.
So that gives you a great sense of how important engineering is to us at the V&A. This has been a fascinating discussion. I must admit, something I didn't know very much about myself, and I hope that listeners out there enjoyed hearing this discussion, which I think shone a real light on the underpinnings of the museum in delivering a great architectural experience to our visitors. So I hope you'll join us again for the next episode of the V&A podcast, bringing you behind the scenes of the Victoria and Albert Museum, the world's greatest museum of art and design.